today on the Errata Movie Podcast. We have a report from the New York Film Festival, and we're going to drink your blood. Dear Robert Davis, I just listened to the beginning of your podcast about the New York Film Festival, and there's something I don't understand. Why are you going to drink our blood? Sincerely, yada, yada, yada. Well, we haven't actually received any feedback yet, since we're still in the middle of the podcast, but that's sort of how I imagine it will read. P.S., your film criticism is really hot. Thank you. Put that away. Okay, so I went to the New York Film Festival back in October, saw a bunch of great movies, and it would be great, such a great idea, to capture the spirit of the holidays that were going on around the film festival and have a Halloween-themed recap of the festival. All you have to do is record your thoughts in a timely manner, check, assemble those thoughts, edit them, push them out on the web. Oh, what is it, December? Well, we may be a little late for Halloween, but it's not too late to talk about the films at the festival, because any big festival shows movies way before they really come out, especially the smaller movies. Maybe a few of them, the Darjeeling Limited, that's out in theaters, but we've already talked about that. The smaller movies, and in some ways the more interesting movies, have not played in theaters, and so there's plenty of time to talk about them, so we'll do that today. But first I have a correction to make. We strive to be very accurate on this podcast, but of course sometimes we make mistakes. We try to correct them. It's especially bad when the mistake is part of a puzzler, because of course one mistake can blow a puzzle, you know, completely out of the water, which unfortunately is what happened here. Last time we gave the answer to the puzzler, and someone wrote in and pointed out that this podcast has no puzzler. I went back through the archives, I looked this up. This person is correct. There is no puzzler on this podcast, so I want to apologize for giving answers to puzzlers that don't exist. It's very unprofessional, very, very unprofessional. And we strive to pretend to try to be professional on this podcast, so I want to apologize. However, this gives us a puzzle. If you can give us the question whose answer would be the answer we gave in the last podcast. Now, it's fairly involved. You might be tempted to go pull out your old algebra book and look for that section about the systems of equations. You know, you have to have as many equations as you have unknowns, but this would be folly. Don't do that. Don't go back and open old textbooks. Always dangerous. And besides, what you want here is Boolean algebra. Anyway, good luck. Don't send us the answers, because we don't really have a puzzler on this podcast. Sorry. Try someone else. Now, if film festival fare is not your bag and you're not that interested in foreign films, you may want to check out our next podcast, which is right around the bend. It's our Speed Round, one of our year-end podcasts, where we talk about a lot of the movies that we haven't had a chance to touch on just yet, including The Savages with Philip Seymour Hoffman and Laura Linney, I'm Not There, the Todd Haynes film about Bob Dylan, a neat documentary called My Kid Could Paint That, The Red Balloon, White Mane, Lions for Lambs, Rendition, Juno, Youth Without Youth, the new Coppola film, Redacted, Margot at the Wedding from Noah Baumbach, Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, Sidney Lumet's new film, American Gangster, Cassandra's Dream, The Water Horse, Persepolis, and There Will Be Blood from P.T. Anderson. So check that out. And joining me, as always, he watches movies in Chicago. You've read his reviews in the Hyde Park Herald, Time Out Chicago, Paste Magazine, Phantom Tollbooth, and on his website, framingdevice.org. And you'll believe me when I tell you that today he's dressed as Frankenstein's monster, J. Robert Parks.
Well, hello, Rob.
Hello, J. Robert.
About a month ago, you were able to go to the New York Film Festival and catch a long weekend of films there, since you hadn't been able to get to Toronto the few weeks before. So what did you see in New York, and what particularly were you excited about?
Yeah, I was there for, I guess, about 5 days, and I feel like I packed in a pretty good set of stuff, both mainstream films and, you know, avant-garde movies and everything in between. So, although I didn't see as many movies as I would have seen in Toronto if I were there with you guys, as I am normally, I saw some of the most talked about films from Toronto, it seemed like. I was really looking forward to the new film from Carlos Regadas, Silent Light, which you saw and really liked in Toronto. And I've liked his previous films, so I was really looking forward to this. I thought it was great.
Good. Because not everyone did, and our friends who saw it in Toronto. Everyone liked it, but not everyone loved it. So,
yeah. I'm not sure yet if I like it more than his other stuff. I think initially I don't. I really liked some of the just very early stuff, like the family sitting around the table. This is a Mennonite family, a Germanic Mennonite family living in Mexico. But just this family, large family, mother and father, and lots of kids sitting around this table, was so calm and peaceful. It's the prayer before the meal. And Carlos Regadas has this particular interest in perspective, and he shoots, you know, each shot is very specifically from someone's perspective, and it's, you know, very careful camera positioning, and yet it's just still and nothing's happening other than they're sitting there praying, and they're all sort of waiting for the father to signal the beginning of the meal. I really there are lots of things like that in the movie, and I liked those a lot.
It's and what did you think of the opening shot with sort of incredible, you know, sequence where you go from night to light, which also I think is really beautifully still and quiet, but incredibly impressive.
Yeah, it's technically neat. Like, I don't know exactly how he did it, and he's not sane. it begins with just a look at the heavens and the stars, and then it sort of does these very deliberate but hard to describe camera movements that move down to this field and these trees. And I think it's something similar to what he was going for in Battle in Heaven, where there's, in an interview that I did with him, I asked him about the title Battle in Heaven, and he liked the idea of each person's individual life being sort of a battle for, you know, their world. Or he also liked this idea of the, you know, of Greek mythology, where the gods are warring up above us over, you know, the fate of an individual. Well, that's sort of the beginning and ending of Silent Light as well, where it begins with this, you know, the universe, and then comes down to practically a blade of grass, you know, this one man and his issues.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, one thing that he said that I thought was very interesting, people compare the film to Audette, a famous film by Carl Dreyer. It has some obvious similarities. But he felt like maybe Sleeping Beauty was a stronger influence than Audette. And his reasoning was interesting. He said he felt like, it's very hard to talk about this movie without talking about the ending, but there's a miracle, let's say. But Carlos Regadas feels like the miracle is incidental. Where in Audette, it is the purpose of the movie. It is the it is the catalyst that changes faith in two different directions in that movie, which is fascinating about that movie, but it isn't the way that Silent Light works. He feels like it's almost just an exit from a triangle in the way it is in Sleeping Beauty, but it isn't the point of what anyone's doing. And I thought that was an interesting distinction and not a surprise, I don't think. But he seems to be bristling a little bit at the comparison to Audette, although it's obvious he did that on purpose, but I think
if you're going to complain about that, then you shouldn't.
No, I don't. I don't think he's complaining about it, but I think that he feels there are other things going on, and that it's not quite so simple as that he's just remaking Audette. Obviously, he's not doing that. He's not doing that. But
yeah, that's right. I can understand that. Yeah. So what else did you really like at New York?
Well, I believe another movie that you saw in Toronto is Paranoid Park, the new film by Gus Van Sant. Now, I really like his recent movies. Ever since, you know, he made Good Will Hunting, and then he made a movie called Finding Forrester. But after that, he sort of branched off into this very strange direction, or at least a lot of people would consider it strange, making three movies, Jerry, Elephants, and Last Days, that are all these very meditative movies. In case of Jerry, it's not even really about anything concrete, but it's very abstract, even though it stars Matt Damon and Casey Affleck, which is intriguing. And I really like that he's done this. And this continues in that vein. It's about skaters in Portland, And he's using non-professional actors, which he has done before, but not extensively. These are all non-professionals, just people that they found, I think, via MySpace.
That's right.
People in Portland, where Gus Van Sant lives. And it's about a sort of tragedy that happens, or maybe even is caused by one of these guys and one of these kids, a teenager, and how he responds to that and sort of what this has to do with his life.
And, or doesn't have to do with his
or
life.
Doesn't is maybe random. Yeah, you liked it, right? You liked the film?
I do. Yeah, I do like it quite a bit. It's for me, the things I like about it are don't have a lot to do with narrative, though. It doesn't. It's not the story. I think is interesting, but that didn't fascinate me as much as like Christopher Doyle's cinematography, which I think is, you know, unbelievable. And so it's that. Those pleasures that I particularly enjoyed, whereas the story I think is fine, but didn't grab me as much as I think other people do.
Yeah, I think I feel the same way. In some ways, there's more going on than in his recent movies. It feels almost a little more like To Die For, where there's a crime and there's a potential cover up, or you know. People are recoiling from that crime, and there's a sort of teenage, I'm not even sure you'd call it angst, but detachment that's at the center of it. And yet in other ways, there's not as much, I think, to ruminate on, at least to me. I felt like I wasn't sort of just lost in thought the way I have been with some of his more recent movies.
Yeah, I agree with that. In that way, I found Last Days a bit more satisfying, even though that movie has, you know, very little going on. I found myself more engaged with Last Days than I did with Paranoid Park, which isn't necessarily a flaw of Paranoid Park. It's just kind of how it felt with me.
Yeah. And by the way, comparing his latest movie to earlier movies like To Die For or even Drugstore Cowboy is no insult.
That's right.
Those are good movies.
That's right.
I'm just trying to pinpoint what it is that's sort of different about this compared to the minimalist movies he's been making recently.
Yeah.
But he's still working very abstractly. I mean, this thing that happens, it involves a splitting in half. And I talked to Van Sant just after the screening. I'm writing a piece on him for Paste. It'll be in the March issue. And he pointed out to me that scene is almost the exact middle of the movie, which I thought was interesting. And I asked him what's, you know, sort of significance that has. And there are a lot of bifurcations in the movie. The kid's family is being split up the middle.
That's right.
There are these sort of echoes of phone calls that are made or not made that are sort of split. So there's some interesting formal and abstract things going on in that movie too. So it's, I think it's interesting.
I hadn't noticed those. And so that's nice. I hadn't thought about that.
Well, it came up, I was asking him about he's credited as the principal editor, on this film and other of his films. And I always love to see that. I love it when, you know, a filmmaker is also the chief editor, because that's like, it seems like so much of the film is determined at that point, you know, in the editing room. And so, you know, he's very much involved in that. And it also is a key part of these movies he's made recently, where the structure of the movie or the decision to let a scene play out forever or not is very, has a lot to do with the personality of the movie.
So. Absolutely. In a completely different film, but I'm reminded of it. I saw Things We Lost in the Fire, the Suzanne Beer film, and which I liked a lot. I think it's really strong. Stars Halle Berry and Benicio del Toro. But one of the interesting things is I was interviewing Suzanne Beer, and then I interviewed the screenwriter as well. And I won't go too much into the movie, but the movie uses somewhat of a flashback structure. So you're going, you know, sometimes you're going back in time, sometimes you're in the present. And I really liked how that going back and forth works in that film. And I just assumed that was part of the writing process, or that's how the movie was always designed to be. But when I was talking to the screenwriter, he said, no, the script is very linear, and they actually filmed it sort of that way. But then in the editing process, Suzanne Beer said she didn't think it was working very well. And so that's when they didn't introduce this this structure until the editing process. And the movie, I think, would be a total failure without it. I mean, if that was a straightforward linear movie, it'd be like really cliched and really banal. But twist things around in the editing process and you have a much, much stronger movie.
Yeah, so much of a movie can be determined at that phase.
Absolutely. Other things from New York?
Well, let's see. Another movie that you saw in Toronto is a movie called The Man from London by Bélatar. Yeah.
And?
I've
already talked about these movies, so
yeah, yeah.
Well, faithful listeners have already heard me pontificate on Bélatar.
Yeah, I just wanted to circle back and make sure that I got my got my points in. Well, the it's interesting what expectations can do to you, because I think most fans of Bélatar, which there aren't many, but the ones who are fans are strong fans, because he's a very distinctive, unusual filmmaker. I think the expectations were very high, and then when I started hearing the reports from Toronto of even people who are really looking forward to it and didn't care for it, well, my expectations were quite low going in, and I liked it a lot. There's a lot of plot, really, for one of his films. It's a bit plot heavy even. There's sort of a caper going on, and there's a case of money that gets moved around. But his movies are typically not about the plot. They're about sort of milieu, and they're about these very, very long takes. Well, in fact, Van Sant told me that he was strongly inspired by Bélatar, and that's what guided him toward these movies that he's made more recently. So it's interesting that we're talking about these back to back.
Yep.
Did you ever see a movie, short animated film called Balance?
Mm-mm.
It's a, I think you can find it on YouTube. If so, I will put the link up on erotimag.com with this podcast. But it's this brilliant short from, I think, the late 80s, an animated stop-action animation short of these guys on a abstract plane, these like figures dressed in trench coats standing on this square hanging out in space. And as they move toward the edge of the plane or away from the edge, the plane tilts a little bit, the square tilts. And so there's this sort of cooperation or antagonism that goes on with these like eight guys who are standing on this space. I kept thinking of that during this because so many platforms appear in this movie of these guys in trench coats standing on them. There's this pier that sort of juts out into nowhere. It's surrounded by black, you know, people get off of a boat and step onto this pier, and yet it's, I don't know where they are, but it's there's nothing around them. There's these platforms throughout. There's this table, tiny little round table in a bar where a guy is sitting eating his lunch, or there's the waitress in the bar carrying drinks on a round tray. All these are normal things they'd see in any movie, except the way he shoots them, it's like they're these hovering platforms. And so I just kept thinking of that movie, and I found that I was very much in sync with the movie on this very abstract level like that. I don't think I understood the plot. I was very tired, having just flown in, from San Francisco, and went straight to I saw this movie on the first night, and his movies are long and slow, so I would like to see it again. But I think even if it isn't among his best, and I'm not a Bélatar expert, so I have sat through Satan Tango, his 7.5-hour film that is very interesting. So I don't know where it fits in with his other movies, but I liked it a lot.
Oh, good. Good. That's nice. And you also saw the Ho Sho Shen film?
I did. Flight of the Red Balloon. Well, as we talked about on a previous podcast, Ho Sho Shen he's from Taiwan, and he's one of my favorites. But this movie is pretty different from some of his others, at least on paper. It's shot in France instead of Taiwan. It's everyone's speaking French, as you'd expect. And it stars Julia Binoche, you know, Oscar-winning actress who was in The English Patient. And she's been in a million movies, but he normally wouldn't have, you know, a well-known actress like that. I guess Shu Qi has been in a lot of his movies. I don't know that he's worked with anyone of the caliber of Julia Binoche, or at least with, I don't mean caliber. I mean fame, I guess.
Yeah.
So,
yep.
And she's great.
She is great. Absolutely.
And just watching her made me think, wow, why wouldn't, a million actors must want to be in a movie like this. I mean, it's not going to be famous or bring them, it's not going to make them a lot of money. But man, she gets to be in a scene for 7 minutes and he lets the camera sit there and she's just in character through that whole time. And things happen, you know, something falls off the table and they just react to it. It's almost like, you know, it's like a play almost, except that it's cinema. You don't have to project your voice. You're just in a room with your characters. And something that you mentioned when we talked about this before is that it feels conventional, even though it has very little plot. Mm-hmm. I think that's an interesting way to put it. I think before this movie, I had almost started putting Hoshashin's movies into one of two categories, either these big, complex, structured films, like Good Men, Good Women, which doesn't necessarily mean cold, because that's a very warm and emotional movie, and yet it has a very complex structure, as we talked about before. Versus his movies like his most recent film, or not most recent, but one of his recent films called Café Lumière, which is almost a minimalist, almost plotless, tiny little movie where there's very little going on. And if you were expecting to unravel something deep or heavy or complex, you'd be disappointed.
Yeah. It's almost a character study.
Yeah.
You know, with you know, as you're just sort of following this woman around and you know, and what she's going through, and even if she's undergoing some huge life change or potential life change, it doesn't actually create any narrative conflict. So yeah,
Flight of the Red Balloon is like that, and yet I think by the end it has a particularly curious ending. That I think made me even question this categorization that I'd made. That, okay, this is one of the simple movies, and I'm not going to expect anything complicated from it. I'm just going to watch, and it's really fun to watch and nice to watch. And it's not, it's about a woman who lives in Paris, and she's a single mother. And, you know, there's nothing major going on in her life, but there are sort of, you know, everyday difficulties and things she's working with. And we see this sort of from the outside, from the point of view of, a nanny who's also a filmmaker from Taiwan.
Yes.
Who sort of joined their life. I think that's a nice little you know, echo of Hoshashin there in the middle of the movie. And yet by the end, there's something very curious about this balloon. Of course, the movie's called Flight of the Red Balloon, and it's an homage to this French short called The Red Balloon, which is going to be distributed by mm-hmm. Criterion Collection.
Mm-hmm. I it's actually playing here in Chicago at the Music Box Theater in 2 or 3 weeks.
Very cool.
Yeah, I'm excited about it. I've never seen it.
Neither have I. So we're sort of at a loss to explain how this movie is connected.
That's right.
However, it doesn't mean the balloon is not intriguing in this movie, because it's sort of just a visual thing, I think, for a lot of it. And yet there's something very mysterious about the way the boy reacts to it in the end, and its position to him, and this discussion of a painting at the end of the movie. So suddenly we've sort of left the woman, we've left Juliette Binoche, and we've left the nanny, and we're just with the woman's little boy, and he's in a class with his classmates, and they've gone to tour the Musée d'Orsay, you know, to look at some paintings. And there's a docent who's telling them about one of the paintings and asking them about it and saying, well, look, what do you see here? And here's someone playing with a ball or a balloon. And is it a boy or a girl? Well, it looks sort of like a girl, but the way they dressed back then, you know, maybe it was a boy. And then who are these people? Well, they're parents. And where are they in relation to that child? Well, they're sort of above and they're looking down. And around that time, the kid looks up and sees this balloon it's been hovering sort of in his life from the beginning of the movie, and now here it is above him, outside a window. He can see it, and I think there's something very interesting about this, and it made me think back on his relationship to his mother in this movie, and about the way she sort of sees his life and the way they interact. I don't know. I'm curious to see it again now, because I think I maybe underestimated it. I'm not saying that it's complex necessarily. I'm saying that I think there's more there than I expected there to be, and I was perfectly happy with it being plain and simple. And then there was this little added thing at the end that made me think, "Wow, I'm gonna think about this movie too." So that's a that's a bonus. So obviously, I liked the movie a lot.
Oh, good, good, good. It's always satisfying when one of your favorite directors doesn't disappoint.
And but here's kind of an interesting thing, maybe to no one but me. there's an echo of Hoshashin in that movie, because there's a Taiwanese filmmaker, sort of amateur filmmaker in the movie. The first scene, the first several scenes of the movie, the kid is wearing a t-shirt that has a lizard on it. Mm-hmm. And when I saw that, I couldn't believe it. I looked down at my shirt. I was wearing the exact same shirt.
Wow.
At that strange moment.
Very, very strange.
Very strange.
So you had a mystic cosmic connection with Hoshi Shen.
That's right.
So my only mystic cosmic connection was that Juliette Binoche was actually at the Toronto Film Festival screening, and she has just as much star power in person as she does on screen. I'll just say that.
She's great. So,
she is great. Anything else?
Well, one thing I liked about the movies that I saw, we've talked about mostly foreign films here, I guess, aside from Paranoid Park, which is definitely American independent, made in Portland. But I feel like I saw a real mix, because I also saw Go-Go Tales, which is it was a midnight screening with Willem Dafoe and director Abel Ferrara present and wild and crazy. I won't go into detail. You can talk to me offline. But this movie, this is a guy who's made The Bad Lieutenant and King of New York and R. Xmas. And his most recent movie is a movie called Mary, which actually starred Juliette Binoche, strangely enough. But this is a comedy that takes place in a strip club. And I think the way I describe it is if Abel Ferrara directed A Prairie Home Companion instead of Robert Altman and Garrison Keillor, I think it would have looked a lot like Go-Go Tales. Mm. Instead of being set in an old radio show, it's in an old strip club, the likes of which there aren't anymore, apparently, and what a sad thing, according to the movie. Willem Dafoe runs this place, and it's sort of down on its luck, and it's going to be replaced with a Bed Bath & Beyond if they don't pay the rent. And there is my favorite part, probably, the closing credits. Sylvia Miles sings, I guess you could say, a film in which she's basically screaming Bed Bath and Beyond and then a lot of expletives. it's not a great movie, but it's a very interesting movie, and I think the main reason for that is it's actually similar to the reason that I liked A Prairie Home Companion. Did you see A Prairie Home Companion?
I did.
It's also not a great movie, I think, and yet one thing that was interesting about that is that Garrison Keillor, public radio host, has all these sort of mythologies around him. He's built this town in his head called Lake Wobegon, and he's written novels and short stories about that, and he talks about it on his radio show. And then there's also the mythology of radio, that he's sort of recreating this this variety show on the air. And yep. I think this movie sort of did a weird third attempt at sort of a mythology surrounding Mr. Keillor that was really none of those, but sort of hinted at all of them. And so it played off of his mythologies, and I liked that. Mm-hmm. And I feel like Go-Go Tales plays off of Abel Ferrara's mythologies. He is he's an independent, you know, through and through, refuses to buckle to Hollywood. He even went to Italy to fund this movie. And he says they don't understand him here, and yet he's a New Yorker. And so I feel like he probably sees himself in the Willem Dafoe character in a lot of ways, that, you know, he's old school, running an old strip club that they just don't like anymore. They'd rather have Bed Bath & Beyond. So, but it was fun.
Oh, good.
Another film that I saw is called In the City of Sylvia.
Mm. Which got rave reviews from friends of ours in Toronto.
It's why, in fact, I sought it out, because it was sort of off of most people's radar. It's by Spanish filmmaker Guerin, is his last name. I wish I could remember his first name. This was made in France, though. And yet it really captured the imagination of a lot of our friends in Toronto, and so I made sure to see it. And it's a beautiful movie. It's very difficult to describe, and in some ways I think it's hard to fully embrace, actually, because it's about a guy who is pursuing a woman who he can't find, but he saw her once and perhaps he'll see her again. That's essentially the story. Maybe he did see her again. Did he? Mm. Did he? Let's follow this woman for quite some time to find out. This guy is essentially a stalker. So you don't want to love his romantic nature too much, because this is kind of creepy. But the movie doesn't pretend like that's not a not an aspect of this. And up until he actually begins following a woman, he's just in a cafe, and he's a sort of a sketch artist, and he sits there sketching women. And it's these long, I don't know how long, 15, 20 minutes maybe, that we sit there in this cafe of him sketching, and it's just a tour de force of perspective and framing. As we were talking about Carlos Regattas earlier, about how careful he is at the dinner table, I feel like this filmmaker was just so careful about how he positioned the camera and the actors in a way that captured that feeling you have at a cafe, where if you were going to take pictures of the people in a cafe, well, you'd never get a clean picture of someone because everyone's covered up by someone else. You know, you get a half of a face here or back of a head here. And he sort of riffs on that visually in a way that brings to mind Picasso paintings, you know, with one person's eye on someone else's head, or, you know, the guy leaning over a little bit, and we get a little bit better view than we had before. And, it's just a lot of, it's hard to describe this in words, but it's, technically, a joy to watch. And I think, rhythmically, it's a lot of fun. It brings to mind something like Sunrise. It's almost a, not a city symphony, but, rhythms of the city, rhythms of the town that infuse what you're watching. So definitely a very interesting movie. I'm not sure I'm ready to call it a masterpiece or even ready to love it, but really intriguing.
What are your reservations about it then? Because it sounds wonderful from that description.
Well, the reservations are that we're made to very closely identify with this guy as the protagonist and as a romantic. And we even, I think, want him to find this woman. Mm-hmm. Find her, pursue her, fall in love as things happen. And yet, if you really, really were following women around like this, that's not quite so wholesome. And although the movie nods and acknowledges that, I'm not sure it really deals with it, because that is what this movie is. This movie is a celebration of following women around and their beauty. And not women in general, but a certain type of woman.
Okay. It strikes me that it's also, I haven't seen the film, so just based on what you're saying, but it seems like it's dealing also with sort of cinema's intrinsic voyeurism. And so, you know, when we see movies, I mean, that's part of what we're doing as well. Is that part of what's going on?
Absolutely. And so on that level, it's interesting in that way. And that's certainly been true of movies from, you know, throughout the cinema age, from Sunrise, as I mentioned, all the way up, you know, Rear Window, or even it reminded me of one of my very favorite movies is Mauvais Sang by Léos Carax with Juliette Binoche. she's on a bus, and it's just the way he shoots her reminds me of this movie where you get glimpses of her and the guy is sees her and falls in love at first sight. And that's definitely a part of cinema. It's a part of male filmmakers. It's a part that's of right. our fun, I think, in going to watch a movie and see attractive people. So yeah, I feel complicit in this, and yet I don't necessarily want to fully embrace this feeling I have while thinking, wow, she's pretty. Oh, so is she. So is she.
Yeah, I see.
Very interesting movie. And made me want to track down his earlier movies.
I hope we in Chicago get a chance to see it too.
Yeah. My guess is it will not be widely distributed. It's a very small movie.
No, it'll be part of one of the small cinematheques here that'll take a chance, and a few of us will go see it. Any other standouts from New York or any disappointments? And it sounds like most of what you saw you enjoyed.
I don't think I saw anything that I didn't like. So yeah, I mean, I also saw a number of avant-garde short programs, and anytime there's a short program, you know, some are better than others. And I think, you know, there were probably a few in there that I didn't care for, but I think there were no features that I didn't like. In fact, there was a fantastic feature of three shorts by avant-garde filmmakers, Pedro Costa, Eugene Green, and Haroon Farooqui. And it was really cool. It was called Memories and was just about the idea of memory. Maybe I'll talk more about that another time.
Okay.
But
the probably at some point in time we'll talk about Pedro Costa, because the retrospective of his work, which I know you've seen quite a bit of, is finally coming to Chicago in a few weeks. So I'll try to catch up with several of his films. I've only seen Colossal Youth, and looking forward to trying to round out his work.
Yeah, actually, I've only seen Colossal Youth also.
Oh, okay. I was under the impression that you had seen others then.
No, I'm anxiously awaiting that retrospective. I'm hoping it'll come to the PFA soon in Berkeley. So,
any fun celebrity sightings on the streets? Any weird, wacky stories to share?
Well, I saw I saw Willem Dafoe. I saw Richard Gere. And who's that woman who plays Bob Dylan in that movie?
Kate Blanchett.
So I did run into a few folks, talked to a few others, but mostly just saw some good movies.
Oh, that's great. There's, as far as I'm concerned, that's what a festival is about.
Hear, hear.
I know some people, they enjoy going to festivals for the parties or for the, the meet and greets. And I can see the appeal of that, but I was just talking about this with someone today. They were asking about Toronto and whether I go to, to those parties. And I said, no, it's festivals are, it's about film. And then it's about, if you're lucky enough to have friends there with you, then it's about talking about films afterwards.
Yeah, which I did get to do quite a bit in New York with some friends there. Oh, so that's great.
Glad to hear you had such a good time, Rob, even though we missed you in Toronto. And we'll talk soon.
All right. Sounds good.
Bye.
Bye. And it sounds like J. Robert is headed to the video store. And it's time for a new segment on the podcast that we call J. Robert's DVD Pick. And this is a good week to start it, since I did most of the talking on this episode. So what's it going to be, J. Robert? When I look at the schedule here of DVD releases, it looks like it could be Eastern Promises or Danny Boyle's Sunshine, or maybe 310 to Yuma. Looks like Zodiac is coming out soon. Maybe you're a fan of Billy Jack or that silly Joshua movie. J. Robert, what is your DVD pick?
I don't watch DVDs.
Well, thanks for listening to this edition of the Errata Movie Podcast. If you'd like to see that little animated short that I mentioned, it's called Balance. Check the website. That's erratamag.com/podcast. And also, you can leave comments for this podcast there and find other episodes in this series. If you want to leave us feedback, you can do it there, or send us email, feedback@erratamag.com, or give us a call at 415-287-4020 and leave a digital voicemail. Hey, maybe we'll use it on a future podcast. Next time, we'll be back with the speed round to talk about a bunch of new movies, and we also have some year-end interviews in the queue, and, of course, a year-end recap. That's coming up. Bye.